subject, dear to my heart, and I hope you'll enjoy it as well. So the subject is manifold pairings. But, you know, what I want to emphasize, since this is mostly a physics audience, is that physicists and topologists, and actually complex analysts, share a sensitivity to dimension. You know that the dimension of your system is extremely important, qualitative features. You know, it's very, with one, two, three, particularly the low dimensions, they're quite well distinguished in your minds, you know, when you think about interacting systems, and topologists think about manifolds. So the take-home message from this little impromptu presentation should be that interacting two-dimensional quantum mechanical systems are really quite special, too. The fact that they're in two dimensions is quite special. And it's not an accident that when we're, you know, we have this workshop talking about physical and mathematical effects that might lead to quantum computation, it's not an accident that we're thinking of two-dimensional physical systems, braid group representations. So there are many things that can be said. You know, a fact often can be looked at from many directions. You could say, oh, well, of course, you know, CFTs, you know, so it has to be two dimensions. You know, there's the braid group, but there's nothing quite analogous in one higher dimension. But I'm going to give you, I think, a novel perspective on what's special about dimension two. So hold that thought, and now we're going to have a digression into topology. So manifolds, of course, are spaces that locally look like Euclidean space, and they can come in a dimension D. And we'll be interested in even the very boring case where D is equal to zero, so that's points. One, circles, surfaces, so we'll be considering D plus D manifolds, and the most fundamental relation of manifolds between manifolds is boundary. So I'll be thinking of D manifolds sigma as equal to the boundary of a d plus one dimensional manifold y, say. So for example, you might think of a circle, which is the boundary of a surface, but the most important example today for me will be a surface, which is the boundary of some three-dimensional manifold. For example, you could picture the three-dimensional manifold as just sort of the inside of it, fill the surface in. Put in space. Now, a very fundamental thing you can do with manifolds with boundary is if the boundaries are the same, you can glue them together. So, if you have just in any dimension a manifold sigma, and if it bounds A, and if it also bounds B, you can reverse the orientation on B. Don't be careless and not put the bars after a while. And you can glue them together, and you can get a manifold without boundary. The boundary's disappeared because it's entered twice, once plus and once minus orientation. So topologists do this without thinking. They're always doing combinatorial constructions, gluing manifolds together. Something that would be kind of a shock to a topologist is to take superpositions of bounding manifolds and glue them together. Well, this is natural to a physicist because you're used to living in Hilbert space. So as long as you have, you know, some object like A and some object like B, you could think of, for example, 1 over the square root of 2, A minus B. That's a perfectly good bounding manifold for our surface. Sigma, I mean, it's sort of not classical, it's a superposition of two cases. So what I want to do today is linearize the notion of bounding and gluing. Yes?
When you acceptability condition?
Well, let's make everything see infinity.
Infinity.
But it's not too important.
In the gluing process, I mean.
Yeah, let's work entirely in the see infinity category today, though we could give this talk in several categories. PL or TOP would work well too. So let's just work out an example of superposition and gluing just to make sure we're all on the same wavelength. So let's start with D equals zero. And are my manifolds will also be oriented, though I didn't explicitly say it. And they won't necessarily be connected. So here's a zero-dimensional manifold, 4 points, and I'll orient it this way. Okay? And now it's the boundary of this manifold. And it's also the boundary of this manifold. Call this one A and this one B. And let's just for practice, so we get good at this, we'll forget numerical factors. Let's compute A minus B paired with itself. So it's essentially bilinear, so we should get four terms. This should give AA, AB, DA, DB. Left out the brackets. The signs are put in correctly. AA will look like this. AB will look like this. BA will look like this. And BB will look like this. Everyone see how I do that? The 4 points are down the middle of each picture. I didn't take the control to change. But you can see the orange and the yellow parts, okay? So now we should collect the terms of this pairing into by diffeomorphism type. So the answer will be 2 times circle.
Sorry, one question. You are talking about something new, or you are talking about something co-bodied in the category?
I'm talking about some work that's in the last 5 years, and co-Borzan category. Let me say, since you said the word co-Borzan category, let me point out that if you do have a manifold sigma of any dimension, it may or may not be the boundary of some manifold. So for example, if this manifold sigma was equal to CP2, is complex projective two-space, that's a four-dimensional manifold in real terms, it's not the boundary of a five-manifold. So then this whole discussion would be vacuous. So I'm discussing only, if you like, sigmas that do bound, otherwise the discussion is vacuous, and then I'm bounding them by something and considering gluing two different somethings together. Does that help? Okay. So this is, I did an example of lowest dimensions, and now let me get a little more formal. Let me say very carefully what it means for A to be different from B. Because you notice in my two examples of A and B, they were both two arcs. And you could say, well, why aren't two arcs the same as two arcs, whether they're orange or yellow? And the answer is this is the equivalence relation I want. If A is the boundary of sigma, and B is the boundary of sigma, we say A is equivalent to B if and only if there exists a diffeomorphism theta from A to B, making the diagram commute. So even though the orange arcs and the yellow arcs are, of course, diffeomorphic as manifolds, they can't be identified so as to preserve the, so as to preserve the inclusion of the boundary. Okay? So now we understand what the different objects are, and now I'll define the space M sigma to be C linear combinations of distinct bounding manifolds. So it's finite combinations, coefficients over the complex numbers of like these A's and B's of bounding manifolds. So manifolds whose boundary is sigma. That's why I put the subscript sigma. And now there's a pairing. I said bilinear before, but I was being sloppy. This will be a sesquilinear pairing from the Cartesian product of this vector space and this vector space to the manifolds that are closed of dimension d plus 1. Closed, I could just put empty set here if I like, meaning manifolds that bound the empty set, but that's the same as closed manifolds. So C linear combinations, closed manifolds. In the example I worked out, you see we ended up in a linear combination of closed one-dimensional manifolds, which happen to be minus two copies of the circle and two copies of two circles. You can't multiply out. That's not four circles. Two circles is the manifold, and this is its coefficient. Sesquilinear means it's linear in the first and conjugate linear in the second, because we should think of this pairing as like a bra and a cat. Okay? So it written out in a formula, if we have the vector in here of summation AI MI, these are the bounding manifolds, and we have the vector in here, summation BI BJ NJ, then it'll go to, by definition, summation over I and J, AI BJ bar, that's the sesquilinear part, MI MJ bar, NJ bar. So the bar means I reverse the orientation, this bar means complex conjugation. And this notation means I glue these two manifolds together along their common sigma, the sigma that they share. So that's the pairing. And you could justifiably call this pairing the universal TQFT, topological quantum field theory. Topological quantum field theories take you from, associate to a surface, a Hilbert space, and if you reverse the orientation on the surface, you sort of get the cats in the Hilbert space, and here are the bras. And if you take these two bounding manifolds and glue them together, you can define the partition function into the complex numbers, and that's going to be a quotient of this larger ring here. So to make that precise, let me write this diagram. We have the manifolds bounding sigma, product manifolds bounding sigma, turning into the closed manifolds. If you happen to know a partition function, Z, on closed manifolds, then you can reduce the pairing further into the complex numbers. And then on this side, it makes sense to divide out by the vectors that pair trivially with everything. These are called the singular vectors. So this, by definition, will be m sigma divided by singular. What is a singular vector? A vector x here is called singular. If for all y here, the pairing x y into this copy of the complex numbers through the partition function is equal to zero. That's the meaning of singular. You can't see the vector paired with anything. So if you divide out by the singular vectors, then you get what are often finite dimensional vector spaces. These would usually be infinite dimensional. And this pairing here is a standard TQFT. In fact, if this partition function, in the simplest case imaginable, where d equals 2,
plus one equals three. A good example of this partition function is the Chern-Simons partition function, which would be the integral over the space of connections of e to the 2 pi I k, the Chern-Simons invariant of the connection.
Okay.
And now this rather formal definition here, dividing the space of bounding manifolds by the singular vectors according to this partition function, this actually recovers the Witt-Natea construction of these Hilbert spaces through symplectic quantization. If you ask, you know, if you open like Natea's book up and read how you define the Chern-Simons Hilbert spaces for a surface, you'll go through all the symplectic quantization, you'll come up with these spaces. I claim this diagram is a formal equivalent. Okay, this is a formal way of producing the same spaces, and that justifies calling this pairing the universal guy, because what you do is you feed in a partition function of your choice, and then you get a particular D3 of 3. Okay, so this is the universal house in your partition function.
So what's the hardest part of calculating from the point of view of this diagram? What's the most difficult part?
What's the hardest part of what?
Of calculating from this point of view. For example, can you partition function is relatively easy to get. I wouldn't imagine it is.
Well, you have to start with the partition function here, and then you, depending on the partition function, you'll get different Hilbert spaces.
Mm-hmm.
If you choose a rather stupid partition function that has no local definition, then it turns out that this will be kind of a crippled TQFT. It won't admit further dissection. So if you don't choose a partition, if you don't choose a partition function which is an integral like this, but something like the number of symplices and the minimal triangulation, you will still be able to proceed to this row here, but you won't further be able to dissect surfaces along circles and talk about a gluing formula where you sum over irreducible representations of particle type. That part of the theory requires a rather special form.
Excuse me. What's the meaning of the singular vector you have?
Oh, I explained that, sorry. Singular vector is a vector here that pairs trivially with anything else.
Okay,
now my main focus is going to not be on the singular vectors, but on the null vectors. So let me explain what I mean by a null vector. My main question about these pairings is I'm going to be asking, do they contain null vectors? Are they sort of Euclidean or Lorentz? So we'll say that a vector x is null if x paired with itself into manifolds equals zero, where x is, of course, itself is non-zero, or it's not interesting. So this should be sort of like a white light vector. So first place, so what the punchline, going back to the difference between dimensions, is the punchline is going to be that certain dimensions have null vectors in their pairings and certain vector dimensions don't. Okay, and then to kind of wrap up, to close the loop, I'm going to explain how you should think of that in terms of quantum mechanics, the existence or non-existence of null vectors. But I think before I proceed, I think from experience, because I've talked about this before, I think you'll be completely lost if I don't show you how there could be a null vector. If I just launch into a proof that say there aren't null vectors, you'll always be wondering in the back of your mind, how could there be a null vector? So I have to sort of show you what a null vector is. So first it sounds absurd that there be a null vector, because it says that when you pair something with itself, it disappears. So, you know, where is it? I mean, if what you put on this side weighed a kilogram and what you put on that side weighed a kilogram, the whole thing should weigh 2 kilograms, happen to be empty. You'd be confused by things like that, unless I give you an example.
So you're not imposing that pairing with any other y would give zero?
No, that's the difference between singular and null. Singular means that if you pair with any y, you get zero.
Okay.
That means a vector that can't be seen by the quadratic form. Null means a vector when you pair with itself, you get zero. You're familiar from special relativity that they're light-like vectors. And you pair them with themselves, they're zero. They have zero norm.
Yeah.
But if you pair them with some other vectors, you get.
Yeah, I'm confused with some other. context where null would be the other class of the set.
Null vector would be singular?
Oh,
what do
you
Hilbert theory, sometimes that's how null is used.
Oh my gosh. So in special relativity, the electric vectors in the light cone are called
That's okay, but
the
theory
sometimes it's just
the other language. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well. Are these vector spaces, presumably infinite dimensional?
If they're non-zero, they're infinite dimensional.
Okay. Can you say countable or separable or something like that?
They're countable. But these quotients, when they arise, will be finite dimensional. So just to make you comfortable with what the idea of a null vector is, I just want to give you the bare bones of a phenomenon that occurs in four dimensions without going into the details of the calculation. But the calculation involves, on the one hand, some combinatorial topology, and on the other hand, some calculations with Donaldson invariants. So it involves sort of both sides of four manifold theory. So I'm just telling you not the calculation, but just the answer. So here's the answer. There's a certain three-dimensional homology sphere. It's called the Maser homology sphere. We've known and studied for other reasons since the 1960s. So it has, it's like the three sphere. It's like the unit sphere in four spaces as far as its homology groups are concerned. But it has a complicated, it has a complicated fundamental group. But let me just draw it as a circle. I'm lowering by two dimensions. And it bounds some contractible manifold A. And it bounds a different contractible manifold, called B. You'd think of it as analogous to disks. Now, this is a secret. I'll just let you in on it. A is actually the same as B, but reparameterizes the boundary differently. So it's very much like the arcs that I previously erased. I had yellow arcs and orange arcs, and they were the same as spaces if you didn't pay attention to how they parameterized their boundaries. Turns out A and B have exactly the same property. They're the same, but they parameterize the boundary differently. They're contractible, and if we form the difference, A minus B, and take the inner product. Again, we'll get these four terms. And the fact is, by direct calculation, this is where sort of the geometric topology comes in. The fact is, when you glue all these things together, you know, for instance, A and B, A and A, etc. When you glue these, they all turn out to be diffeomorphic to the four sphere. So the calculation proceeds that we get the four sphere minus the four sphere minus the four sphere plus the four sphere. And this is how you can get a null vector. When you collect the coefficients according to the diffeomorphism types of the outcome, according to the types of the manifolds that result from the pairing, the coefficients cancel. So you get zero times four sphere and zero times every other manifold. So it's zero in the vector space spanned by closed manifolds. So that's what you should think of as what happens. It's some kind of a magical cancellation when you have a null vector. So this is kind of the combinatorial part of the argument. I said something about Donaldson theory. Where does that come in? It's rather challenging to know that A and B are different in the first place. And this comes back to a calculation that was done in the 80s. Comparing the Kummer surface to its logarithmic transform. It turns out that by Donaldson invariants, or more recently by Seibert-Witten invariants, you can often tell four manifolds apart that are very similar, that have the same homotopy type. And in particular, inside the Kummer surface, you can find this contractible manifold A in a complementary piece. And if you just take A and cut it out along this homology 3 sphere and glue it back in with a twist, it turns out it transforms to, well, in my notation it would be B glued onto the complement, which is equal to the log transform of the Kummer surface, which is distinguished. So that's how you know that A is different from B. They were the same. There was a diffeomorphism between the two extending the identity on the boundary. Then these two manifolds would be diffeomorphic, but they're distinguished by this calculation. So now let me state the main theorem and tell you what it has to do with quantum mechanics, and then sketch a little bit about the proof. So, by the way, the first part of this discussion, this high-dimensional part or four-dimensional part, was done with a number of collaborators about 3 years ago, and one of them, Joost, is in the audience. And I'll just say et al. I can't remember. A lot of my friends, Juan, did that with us too. I think Alexi could tie him. So many of us kind of played with this one summer at Microsoft. Redmond. More recent work is the three-dimensional case. So this is with collaborators Caligari at Caltech and Kevin Walker. This is for the sort of the 3D part of what I'm going to say. Anyway, the general theorem is that when D plus 1 is greater than or equal to 4, null vectors are very common. I mean, they can be produced in every dimension and for a variety of d-dimensional manifolds. When d plus 1 is less than or equal to 3, the pairings are positive. So they do not exist, null vectors, for any surfaces or collection of circles. So we call this three-manifold positivity, is the kind of catchword. We're mostly interested in the case d plus 1 equals 3. So this kind of strange calculation that I pictured for you here, linear combinations of manifolds that somehow cancel out, doesn't happen for d plus 1 equal 2 or d plus 1 equal 3, that's d equals 2. Okay, so I hope I tantalized you early with the statement that this had something to do with quantum mechanics in three dimensions. So let me try to make good on that assertion. So remember my usage of the word a null vector is one that pairs zero with itself, okay? Now, what I claim is that the null vectors in M sigma cannot be detected in any physical quotient V sub sigma. So remember, V sub sigma is the quotient I get out of dividing the singular vectors. So just to recall, the singular vectors are the ones that are completely hopeless. Those are the ones that pair zero with everything. So we can't hope to learn anything about them at all by studying pairings. But assuming we divide out by the singular vectors, we may still, in practice, hope to detect a null vector by pairing it not with itself, but with some other guy outside the light cone, or just different from itself. But the point is, these quotient PQFPs, in most interesting cases,
come from, you know, something like the Trent-Simons action, or maybe they come like in the Digraph-Witten case, finding group D50s or some counting of covering spaces, that's another partition function that works. But in the interesting cases, the cases with physical motivation, this isn't just some successful linear pairing on a vector space. This is positive. But this isn't a mathematical, this isn't true universally mathematically, but in physically interesting cases, these vector spaces are Hilbert spaces. They're endowed with a positive definite Hermitian inner product. And and that structure tells you that that only the zero vector can pair with itself to zero. If you have a Hilbert space, you're very used to this. Inside Hilbert space, positive definite inner product, every vector pairs non-zero with itself. Every vector has a positive norm. That means if this quotient is physically motivated, that comes, for instance, from the Trent-Simons partition function, then a vector x up here, which is null, can necessarily descend to the trivial vector here. Because null means its pairing with itself is already zero here, so it's zero here. So therefore, when it goes down here, it pairs zero with itself, but the only vectors in a positive Hilbert space that pair zero with themselves are the zero vector. So therefore, in a physical quotient, we cannot see a null vector, so we can learn nothing about them. But these quotients, the reason I'm calling them physical is we really do believe they arise as the physics of two-dimensional interacting electron systems on this surface sigma. I mean, these are models for these. These are models for the Hilbert spaces that Nick was talking about in the previous talk. So these things actually, these quotients, which discuss somehow some mystical way, the three manifold which the surface bound, really arise from the two-dimensional interaction physics on the surface. So if you have a null vector, what it tells you is that the physics in dimension D is incapable of capturing all the information contained in the bounding D plus one manifolds. So to be very concrete, it says that bulk physics, you know, three-dimensional physics, is not smart enough to know anything about the balance and invariance in dimension four. They're completely oblivious. Three-dimensional quantum mechanical systems, because of a generalization of this construction, are completely incapable of distinguishing balance and invariance. But because of three-dimensional positivity, we at least have the in-principle hope that every fact about the topology of three manifolds is accurately reflected in quantum mechanical structure on two-dimensional systems. Yes,
yes, some years ago, about the time we wrote the papers on the Jones polynomial, we wrote a field theory for
that was
the balance of theory. So
that's
a field theory.
So yeah, but it's not positive. So so the point is, in fact, the words topological quantum field theory appear first in this 1988 paper of Witten, and the purpose of the paper was to cast the Jones polynomial, or the Donaldson invariant, sorry, at the time, in the context of field theory. But he had to introduce what he called the topological twist, which spoiled the signature. It was a mathematical construction in order to put the theory in this form. And it's quite possible mathematically to lose this positivity. This is a well-known phenomenon. For instance, if you take the Fibonacci theory, which we know very well, it's the one related to SU2 level 3, and simply replace the golden ratio wherever it occurs with its Galois conjugate, you'll see that some of the quantum dimensions of the particles, or the quantum dimension of the tau particle, becomes negative. So that means this pairing is no longer positive. Some vectors appears positive and some vectors appears negative. So we know plenty of examples of mathematical PQFTs which are not positive, but the ones that come in a bona fide way from from lattice scale microscopic physical interactions that come as the restriction to the ground state of some Hamiltonian of a Hilbert space that describes microscopic degrees of freedom. Any such TQFT will obey a positivity and be blind to null vectors. So sort of this is the underlying kind of take-home message, is that two-dimensional quantum systems, in principle, are smart enough to know everything about three-dimensional topology. And, of course, now we're supposed to know everything about three-dimensional topology because of Perlman. And in higher dimensions, quantum mechanical interactions are only going to be able to capture some of the information about these boundaries.
Okay.
Hey,
Mike?
Can I try to translate this to language I'm more familiar with?
Yeah.
Nick told us about his various works where these Hamiltonians that have exponential degeneracy of the ground state and topological.
You mean exponentially accurate degeneracy?
But also degeneracy of the ground state that grows exponentially with the number of quasi particles,
yeah.
And topological interaction between them,
gradient,
yes. And so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's
an EQFT. Yeah, that answer. So now, what you're telling us is that these considerations prove that that cannot happen in a 3 plus 1 dimensional Hamiltonian, or am I taking it too
You're
too
overstating it slightly. What it's saying is that these considerations show that the information that can be extracted, if you succeed in generalizing, if we come back 10 years later, we're having this same colloquium or the same seminar meeting on three plus one is our focus now. You know, we're really interested in three-dimensional physics and we're going to build three-dimensional devices and so on. It still won't be true that these three-dimensional quantum mechanical systems will be rich enough to reflect everything that's going on in four dimensions. That's what I'm saying. They're handicapped. They're not as clever as the two-dimensional ones, which in principle can know everything about three dimensions. It's not that there are no 3 plus 1 dimensional TQFTs, that would be an overstatement.
Okay.
But they're weaker. They don't capture all of four dimensional topology.
Okay,
so maybe I just take 5 minutes to say something about the proof in the three dimensional case. So the idea is that there's some partially ordered set P and a function from closed three manifolds. Let's just say closed three manifolds. So three manifolds without contact, three manifolds without boundary. Call the function C for complexity. There's some way. And it's very complicated, but I'll tell you a little bit about it. But there's some way of assigning in this partially ordered, well, actually think of it as ordered. There's some way of assigning in this set to every three manifold kind of a ranking where it is, you know, how important this three manifold is. Okay? And the complexity C obeys what's called diagonal dominance. So diagonal dominance means that the complexity of A glued together with B is less than the max of the complexity of A glued with itself and the complexity of B glued with itself. So in other words, if you take the AIMI, that's your vector, you want to know if it's null, and you pair it with itself, or AI, MI, AJ, MI. Then you get summation AI, AJ bar, MI, MJ. This diagonal dominance condition says that if you look at this square array of closed manifolds that you get by the different combinations of the pairing, that the complexity of an off-diagonal term is less than one of the two corresponding diagonal terms. It's always beaten by something on the diagonal.
But notice the formula, which I've erased for the pairing, well, here it is again, has a complex conjugation in the second factor. So that means on the diagonal, this is positive. It's positive real on diagonal. So this is enough to prove the theorem, if you can find this complexity function and show it's diagonally dominant, because it's impossible for all the terms in this square to cancel out if the maximum complexity is achieved on the diagonal, because the things on the diagonal have positive coefficients, and no other manifold can cancel them out if it has a different diffeomorphism type. I mean, you collect the manifolds according to their type, and if the maximum complexity, by definition, cannot occur anywhere else in the diagram, anywhere else in the square. So even if everything else cancels out, the maximum complexity, AI union AI bar, will persist. So it's a formal consequence. But now the fun thing about the proof is constructing this complexity function. And it turns out this is an entire course in three-manifold topology from the 1950s to present, because in order to build the complexity function, you have to sort of consider every aspect of the theory of three manifolds, all the way from Dane's lemma in the 1950s to some lemmas from Perlman's work of a few years ago. It's sort of a nice sort of swan song of three-dimensional topology to go through this proof, because before you forget about it, you recapitulate it. So I'll just take 1 minute to tell you. So this complexity function has many terms. It's some complicated, very long tuple. It's somewhere, by the way, well, let's see. I can tell you how they. I can tell you the way the complexity begins is with the term C0, which is just the number of components. So a manifold with 7 components would be more complex than a manifold with 5 components, and so on. And this basically sort of lines up the pi 0 part of the picture. It says that if diagonal dominance fails at A and B, at least look the same on the level of components. The next term in the complexity, C1, is supposed to line up the fundamental groups in some sense. But in order to line up the fundamental groups, we actually go through all the Digraph-Witten TQFTs. So this part of the complexity actually contains the Digraph-Witten finite group TQFTs for all finite groups. So we have to first order the finite groups and then take the partition functions with respect to these theories. And after putting this in the complexity, we sort of understand pi 0 and pi 1. Then we come to a prime part of the complexity, discusses, which contains a few pieces, but the most interesting piece is the hyperbolic part. And the hyperbolic term in the complexity is minus hyperbolic volume. So I'll just end with a little picture which shows how this comes up. There's a beautiful theorem of Ian Eagle, Peter Storm, and Bill Thurston, which says the following. If you take two hyperbolic manifolds, A and B, with totally geodesic boundary, and you take their volumes and add them together, this is less than or equal to the volume of the two manifolds glued together. And equal holds only if the gluing is by isometry. So this looks strange, because if I glue two things together, why shouldn't the volume be exactly equal to the volume of the pieces? But the meaning of volume is it the volume in the hyperbolic metric? So there's this tremendous Thurston machinery that shows that if you have the hyperbolic manifold A and B and you glue them together, well, there'll be some kind of crease where you glue them if you don't glue by an isometry. But the Thurston machinery allows you to rehyperbolize the union. And when you do, this theorem says that volume goes up. Except in the trivial case you glued by an isometry, in which case you don't have to use the machinery of rehyperbolizing. This is the part of the proof that uses the Perelman, actually.
So somehow reminiscent of the second law of black hole thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
The surface area of a black hole has to always increase.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
example, if you amalgamate two black holes.
Yeah, I think there's an anthropic way of thinking about this. So I just want to point out why this fact is related to a complexity function. So I'm saying the term in the complexity at the appropriate moment is minus the volume. That means you have higher complexity if you're smaller. Okay? We have to come up with some kind of crazy complexity function on manifolds that just needs to have this property that the complexity function prefers the diagonal. It's going to have its maximum on the diagonal. And you see that if the function is minus the volume will be bigger. So let me just get rid of that double negative. Volume will be smaller on either the double of A or the double of B than it will be on this guy. That follows from this inequality. Except for the special case you glue by an isometry, and that has to be handled later. But this is an example. Minus volume is an example of something example of a complexity that favors the diagonal terms because of this theorem. So what you have to do, this is kind of just illustrate the spirit of the argument, you have to kind of filter your way through three-manifold topology looking for invariants that favor diagonal versus non-diagonal, that give more weight to doublings than twisted doublings. Okay, well, thank you very much.